Good afternoon. Coots, as some of you know, has been holding a series of conversations involving our clients and very distinguished guests to talk about the background to the COVID-19 crisis. We've had very high-level scientific conversations. We've had a fascinating conversation on resilience and mental health against the background of big challenges in this. But at the top of everyone's mind now, and perhaps particularly after the Chancellor of the Exchequer's statements yesterday, is the future of the economy. And the future of the economy, of course, interacts profoundly with our future health status as well. Now, we thought of having a panel. We thought of having someone from industry, someone from the Bank of England, someone, an academic economist, someone with regulatory experience, someone perhaps who knew a little bit about the Chinese economy. And we were assembling this when it occurred to me that we actually have all this in one person, rather close at home, in Howard Davis, who has a quite extraordinary CV when you come to look at it. He's been chairman of the FSA, he's been director of the CBI, he's been director of the London School of Economics. He was Chancellor Nigel Lawson's private secretary. He's worked in the Treasury. He did the Airport Commission in his spare time, and the Man Booker Prize, and the Tate Gallery, and the National Theatre, and he plays cricket. And he makes me feel rather tired just sitting here. So, Howard, welcome. We couldn't have anyone better to discuss. He is also, I should mention, my boss, because he's chairman of RBS. It's a delight to have you with us today, Howard. Now, you recently delivered, one further thing I should say is that if my Wi-Fi in darkest Somerset goes down, Mo Said, who runs our asset management business, will step into the breach and carry on, let's hope. Mo would be excellent to see, but we hope it doesn't do that. Now, Howard, you recently delivered an excellent Tour d'Horizon lecture, the Dahrendorf lecture, the lecture set up in honour of great friend of both yours and mine, I think, previous director of the LSE, Ralph Dahrendorf. And you talked about the alphabet soup of shapes of the recession. What do you think it looks like now?
Yes, thank you, William. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a privilege to talk to such a good audience about what is, as you say, at top of everybody's mind at the moment. I did say in that lecture that the debate about the future of the economy had resolved into a kind of battle of the letters, if you like. So we had the V people who argue that the economy has gone down sharply, the downstroke of the V, as a result of government action around the world to close down the economy. So you can't be surprised that there's been a huge plunge in GDP in most parts of the world. But that once the restrictions are released, we'll go zooming back up the other side of the V and end up pretty much where we started. And a lot of the government schemes to provide furlough support for individuals or bounce back loans, as the jargon has it, for small businesses, are predicated on the assumption that that's what you'll get. The bounce back loans clearly described in order to capture the idea you take this money, just tide you over the gap of the V, and then you'll be back where you started, and on we go. Then there are others who say, well, you know, the restart is going to be a bit more difficult because it isn't going to be just a case of relaxing government constraints and everybody will go back to the way they were, because there will be one scarring of the economy. Some firms will have gone out of business, and also there'll be psychological reluctance, and we can see that. We've seen that in the difficulty of reopening schools, etc., that people will be reluctant to go back, reluctant to go on the public transport, reluctant to go into crowded offices. And so the notion of a very sharp recovery, unless we suddenly had a miraculous discovery of a vaccine, is probably not likely. Then there are others who say, well, actually, the biggest risk is of a second outbreak of the disease. I think second wave I find a little bit misleading, because where we've seen the second outbreaks, whether it's Leicester or Melbourne or Germany, Gütersloh, whatever, it's been relatively isolated, not a whole country. I think that's relatively unlikely, but that we would see some bouncing around. So you'll go down and you go up a bit and then you down again and then back up a bit. And there's the W people, and they argue that that's the most likely outcome. And then there are the real pessimists who are on the letter L, who say we've had a very sharp shock to the economy, but that shock will be so bad that large parts of the economy will just be knocked out and will not recover for a very long time. And so you'll just sort of bounce along the bottom for quite a period. And one can see that there are some respectable arguments saying that might be the case. My own not totally serious prescription was that it might be a Q, where we went round and round in circles for a bit and then eventually found a way out. But at the moment, it's interesting that the Bank of England has come back, I think, to the view that it is going to be more of a V than anything else, because actually the indicators, what are called the sort of fast indicators, the things that you can measure more or less in real time, this is in the jargon called nowcasting, rather as opposed to forecasting, you know, what is happening this week? And it's quite interesting that quite a lot of economic activity has come back fairly quickly. I mean, they divide spending into staples, essentially food and the things you can't do without. Toilet paper for some reason became an obsession, as you remember, at the beginning of all of this. But an expenditure on food and toilet paper, I mean, food at home I'm talking about, and those kind of basics, fairy liquids of this world, have been pretty much flat. There was a bit of a dip, and then it kind of went back up to pretty much normal and has stayed there. And then there's what they call kind of discretionary consumer spending, not hospitality, which has been sort of banned. And then there's been kind of capital expenditure. I don't mean factories, but I mean, you know, a fridge or a new vacuum cleaner or whatever, things that are non-consumables. And interestingly, they've come back really quite quickly, surprisingly quickly. So of these different components of expenditure, the only one that's currently pretty flat, of course the Chancellor tried to do something about it today, is the, what's often called the social expenditure, you know, into which you throw all kinds of things like haircuts and restaurants and cinemas, etc. And all of that has remained sort of quite depressed. So the bank sees quite a big upturn from the bottom of the V. And they still are talking about a V. I've got to say, if you really nailed me to the wall, I'm more of a U person, because I think that there will be parts of the economy which will take some time to coax back into life. You know, I don't think that there will be as much travel. I don't think that there will be as much visiting of very busy restaurants. You know, it's one thing to go to meet restaurants on German Street where the tables are a long way away, and at Wilton's you're in a booth anyway. You know, that I'm sure will come back for Coutts customers in particular. But, you know, the hugger-mugger restaurant where you're kind of like this, and you know, I think there will be a lot of nervousness about that. That's a trivial example, if you like. So I think that whereas we are seeing a decent pickup, I suspect it won't be quite as fast a pickup as people hope, because I believe that there will be these social and psychological obstacles to overcome before people go back to normal.
Do you think the Chancellor was on the right lines yesterday? I mean, if you've been his advising him as you once advised chancellors, what would you have been saying to him?
Well, I am fairly sure that this was more of a politically constructed intervention than one which will have a big impact on the shape of the recovery. And I don't say political in really a pejorative way, because, you know, governments, I mean, we probably all know, and the Chancellor was reasonably straightforward about it today, to his credit, that there is going to be a significant increase in unemployment. And unless we were to nationalize whole swathes of the economy for a long period, we probably can't actually avoid that. But it's very uncomfortable, of course, for a government to say, well, you know, it's going to happen, so we'll just let it roll over us. You can't do that. It's not realistic. So I think to create a sense of momentum and to give a bit of a boost here and a bit of a boost there, you know, a bit of a boost in the, to the housing market by changing stamp duty, a bit of a boost to the hospitality sector with 10 quid off on Monday to Wednesday meals, etc. You know, a bit of a boost on a longer term to reducing VAT is all a set of things that will probably help a bit at the margin. I doubt if they will have a major impact on the shape of the recovery myself, but they may be working on a kind of nudge theory of the economy, which is not ridiculous. It's not totally based in an analysis, frankly, but that, you know, just a bit of a nudge to say to people, okay, you haven't been out for a meal for 4 months, you know, here's a little bit of a discount to get you going, and you go and you find you it's all right, and then you go again. You know, so it may well be based on a kind of nudge theory, which I think potentially quite interesting, potentially quite useful. So I'm not against really any of it. I suppose personally, I guess I kind of am against the stamp duty changes. I think the housing market was actually picking up anyway, and I think that will probably cost them quite a bit of money for not a lot. The evidence suggests that when you change stamp duty on housing, then you tend to defer, delay, or advance purchases, but you don't have much of an impact on the market over, a 3-year period. You can't really see the effect of it. You just pull stuff forward or push it back or whatever. So I'm not enthusiastic about that. I think it's going to cost the government some money for probably not a lot of activity.
Now, the really hard graft is obviously going to be in the medium and longer term. When I was chief secretary many years ago, I was worrying myself about an annual deficit of 45 billion, I think we were talking about then. They seem lost in the margins now. So what's going to be the right time? And is it going to be to start grappling with the long term? Because we can't carry this debt forever. Is it going to be taxes? Is it going to be, the old siren song of, oh, well, you'll just grow your way out of it. That never quite works. There are going to have to be tax increases, aren't there, at some point?
Well, yes, this is the big question. And what I think the Chancellor needs to be getting onto fairly soon is some kind of fiscal framework. Because if you ask the government at the moment, what is their eventual aim in terms of fiscal policy, there is currently no answer. Now, I don't say that in a super critical way because, you know, hey, there are a lot of companies who had strategies until March and, you know, now all bets are off. And, you know, that's understandable in the circumstances. But I do think the government will need to put in place some kind of fiscal framework in order to give people the confidence and the markets the confidence that eventually this super nova of debt will be gradually not eliminated, but will be gradually brought under control. At least this rate of change will be brought under control. And I think that's pretty urgent, actually. And he hinted at it a bit today in an interview this morning where he said, well, we may have to have some limitation on debt interest as a percentage of GDP. Because, of course, the big thing that one has to note about this debt is, you know, interest rates are so low that actually the debt servicing burden for the government is not worrying at all at the moment. In fact, it's lower than it has been at many times in the last 30 or 40 years because the interest rate on government debt, particularly the new government debt, is really low. So, but I think some kind of control of that kind, which would mean that you could expect the government to act if interest costs started to rise, then they would have to raise taxes in order to offset them, but that they could allow the borrowing to run for a while and allow the government, the economy to recover without having to bring it back under control. Now, that is probably probably just about okay for the time being. And it's a good job it is, because it's not at all clear what the alternatives available are. Yes. Because, as you say, you know, you can put taxes on, but that's what we used to call austerity. And there's not much of a market for that at the moment in any part of the political spectrum. So I think that's not going to be possible. Osborneism is not currently alive and well, I don't think. So I don't think we can do that. Then, as you say, if you look back at previous periods of history where we've ended up with very large amounts of debt, the economy has grown more rapidly than the interest rate. And if that happens, as it happened in the 50s and 60s, where we then worked off the debt we ended the Second World War with, that was a good way of doing it. And there are only two other ways. One is inflation, which, of course, if you allow it to rip, then you rapidly inflate away the value of the outstanding debt. And lastly is what economists call financial repression, where you hold the interest rate down deliberately. So effectively, you tax savers. Effectively, you get savers get less than they expected, and indeed, maybe at the limit, they actually have negative interest rates. So that's the other way of doing it. And in the moment, that's actually what's going on, because you know, the government is doing that by the expedient of the Bank of England buying large proportions of every gilt-edged stock issued and holding the interest rates down to a level below current inflation and below expected inflation, because current inflation is still 1.5%, and yet your government's borrowing at, you know, less than 0.5% over 10 years, and the base rate is 0.1. So financial repression is what is happening at the moment, but that takes a very long time to work through, particularly to work off the scale of debt that we've currently had.
And that presents quite a tricky problem for banks, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you've got a negative real interest rate now. Some countries, Switzerland, for example, have actually moved into nominal negative rates. And I mean, this is a question I asked my chairman with some interest. How do you run a great big bank with no net interest margin, or virtually no net interest margin? It's quite a problem for the financial system as a whole, isn't it?
Yeah, William, I wouldn't be a banker if I were you. and indeed, I could arrange for you not to be.
Thank you very much indeed. That's very helpful. Yeah.
But no, it is very tricky, and is really the fundamental reason why banks are valued as they are. I mean, you know, I'm not expecting people to get their hankies out at this point, but it is worth pointing out that the people who have suffered probably the most in this crisis so far have actually been shareholders of banks who have lost approximately half their value. I mean, our share price and Lloyd's, almost exactly the same, have gone down by 50% since the beginning of the year. HSBC and Barclays, partly because, you know, Barclays got a big US business, HSBC a big Asian business. But even there, they've gone down by between 35 and 40%. Standard Chartered the same, and indeed some others, the Irish banks, are down by over 60%. So, and that's because people look at the interest rate prospect and the growth prospect, and they say, well, two things. One, banks are going to face a big hit in terms of losses on commercial lending, particularly. And secondly, that the interest that they can earn on their deposits is significantly reduced. And as we know, in countries like the UK, typically banks have paid for the infrastructure of banking by essentially investing the float. You know, so the average ordinary person, just ordinary working person on the average national wage, probably keeps, you know, £500 in his or her account during the month. It'll be bigger at the start and smaller at the end. And on average, let's say £500, it doesn't seem a lot, but actually if the bank can invest it and get a 5% return on it, that pays for the basic business of banking. And most people, as you know, don't pay for their current account, ordinary ordinary bank accounts are free if in credit is the sort of jargon phrase. And that model of banking, which has been the case in the UK and Ireland as well, is not viable at zero interest rates, really. There just isn't the margin to pay for the infrastructure. So it's a difficult conundrum for banks, and would be made worse by negative interest rates, which I think would be quite a difficult policy choice for the Bank of England to make. In some countries where they've done it, banking is paid slightly differently. People pay per transaction, or they pay a certain amount for holding their current account. That doesn't happen in the UK so far for the majority of people. Obviously, if you have added value accounts like you have at Coutts, I mean, as I do, what pays for that, you get more for your money, you get all kinds of advice and services, etc. But an ordinary person who has a NatWest account or a Nationwide account, you know, they don't pay for that. And that's very difficult with negative interest rates, very difficult with negative interest rates, almost impossible.
You might argue that the populist thing, which got a clap and a cheer in this country and in Europe, of suppressing the dividend payments, so that just makes the cost of capital for banks in the medium term higher, doesn't it? Which isn't a very sensible thing to do, but one can understand why politicians did that.
Yes, it was an understandable, very short-term reaction. Mm-hmm. But the question is begged as to what happens next. Mm-hmm. And if you have a blanket ban on dividends, no matter how well-run and well-capitalized you are, that creates a rather peculiar incentive structure for banks. It's not the one that regulators really want to have. As soon as we're allowed to pay dividend again, logically what we should do is pay every bit of surplus capital away that we could, because we might face another ban. So, you know, yeah. it would be an irrational thing to do, but that would be the incentive structure you'd be creating. So I do think that the regulators have got to think hard about that and come up with a better answer than a simple dividend ban.
I agree with that. Well, enough about banks as such. You quoted Mervyn King in that lecture I referred to, the Dahrendorf lecture, with a rather good phrase of his that major economies may be global when all goes well, but when life support mechanisms are needed, the national government is the relevant authority. Now, do you foresee one of the effects of this crisis, and you know a bit about China, you know a lot about how Europe works, as being a damaging crisis for international cooperation? All our instincts is, surely in a crisis like this, we ought to be cooperating, but the drive back to a sort of nationalism seems rather preeminent at the moment.
Yeah, I think that is, in a way, the most worrying thing that's going on at the moment. If you contrast the position today with the position after the last crisis, at the last one, the instinct of global leaders was to huddle together for warmth. Yeah. And they assembled summits, they expanded the G7 to the G20, Gordon corralled everybody in the Excel Center in the Docklands. And there was a lot that was done, actually, particularly on the financial side, and which is the area I know most about. But, you know, international agreements were reached that were pretty effective, actually, from which we are benefiting today, because an agreement was reached then to increase significantly the amount of capital that banks held, which has been difficult, but has been achieved. You know, those new Basel, as they're called, Basel standards, have actually been implemented, so that it's noticeable that we're well into this crisis now. And I'm not saying it won't happen, but have we seen any banks fall over? No, we have not. Have we seen banks close down and say we can't lend? No, we've not. And last time, of course, we did. We had bank runs and we had banks saying, whoa, you know, we can't afford to lend. Credit crunch, if you remember. It's often interesting just to reflect for a little while in any crisis on the dogs that aren't barking. Mm. And the credit crunch dog is not barking at the moment. You know, the banks are able to lend. The problem is consumer demand, not availability of finance. And so all of those things were done after the last crisis by a lot of collective agreement, which Gordon Brown gets quite a bit of credit for, I would say. And you've seen the opposite been the case here, where even as we've gone into this very difficult economic period, you know, it's trade wars, it's tariffs, it's and, you know, at the moment, it looks like China and Australia will be at war quite shortly. You know, today, I mean, completely extraordinary things are going on. And this is not very optimistic. And we're seeing in the financial side, we're seeing the Americans rewriting some of their regulation that was done after the crisis. And, you know, I can't see an international consensus on financial regulation emerging at the moment. Actually, even on dividends, there was a different policy taken in the US and in Europe and in the UK, which was slightly surprising. In 2009, I think they would have had a common view on it. Now, they don't seem to. So it is a worrying time, and you have to hope that when part of it, I'm sure, completely psychologically, is that they don't see each other, of course. You know, I mean, Macron and Johnson met for an hour or two the other day, but, you know, hardly anybody has actually met. And I do think that makes a difference, actually. They're sending texts and tweets to each other at the moment. So I really hope that when the autumn comes and there is a possibility of having a real live summit, that, you know, sitting in a room, people go, "Woof, let's just try to calm this down."
Now, my next question is also one that has come in from one of our clients, Bianca, which is about building our way out of all this. We've got this huge, I mean, for a moment, we've been diverted from the underlying climate crisis. We need to build economies of a different shape to take us through that. We know a lot of the things we need to do, a lot of them. It's a matter of engineers, not scientists, in a way. Now, we have huge projects to do. Why aren't we using this, says Bianca, as an opportunity to reform our economy fundamentally to meet that climate control and climate change threat?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question and a very important question. I suppose the realist in me says, well, fine, but we know that big transformations in the economy do come at the price of disruption of the traditional ways of doing things, and that comes at the cost of some unemployment. Now, it may be transitional, frictional unemployment, if you like, as economists might put it, but, you know, for the individual who loses their job, I don't think they're terribly interested whether their unemployment is structural or frictional or transitional. You know, they just see that they haven't got any money, so, and they can't look after their families. And so I think it's going to be, I hear what people say about a green recovery, and some people, I think, have bent their minds to trying to square the circle between a position where unemployment is going to rise anyway, and therefore that's a very difficult time to engage in structural change that might make that worse in the short run. People have started to say, well, are there employment-rich green things that we can do? Mm-hmm. The obvious one being, home insulation and boiler replacements and things. And that would be great. Whether an unemployed actor is the person you want to replace your boiler is perhaps a question, but nonetheless, they're probably, may trivialize it a little bit, but, you know, there are training requirements, you know, if you're going to do that kind of thing. But I do think that those kinds of initiatives, a big program of home insulation and boiler replacement and things, would really be a rational thing to do at the moment. And maybe that's where you should be fiddling around with your VAT and your subsidies, and maybe the Treasury will get to that point. So I do agree that there is an opportunity for economic restructuring in the light of this climate change imperative, but I do think it's probably going to have to be thought about in a way that recognises that it's going to have to be the employment-rich bits of it are going to be the things that we need to do the most in this environment, because that realistically is going to be more politically acceptable and more socially acceptable as well.
Yeah, it is a slightly different terms of trade. The very first job I ever had in the civil service 100 years ago, and I was sitting as a junior in a group of very senior officials who were talking about retraining the shipyard workers. They were all the shipyards on the Clyde were going down at the time. And I innocently, I thought I'd missed something. I said, excuse me, what are we retraining them for? I didn't hear. And there was a silence in the room because no one knew what they were retraining them for. And to some extent, yep. They were rescued by the new technologies in after a prolonged period of horror for those people, did, I suppose, in the end come along. At least now we do have something to aim at. There are pretty obvious things we need to do. And that, would you agree with that?
Yes, I think I would agree with that. And there are a couple of areas of the economy that everybody nods and says they're very, very important. And then somehow there's always something that's more important. And the two I mean are the FE sector, you know, where it is the case that we spend more nationally per student, a lot more in higher education than we do in further education. And yet at the same time, another part of our brain, we know that trades and crafts and those kinds of skills, you know, plumbers and whatever, are actually in short supply. You know, we all know that in our own lives. It's very difficult to find those people. If you ever do find a reasonably competent, plausible guy who can do that kind of thing, you know, you cling onto them. You know, we have a Polish guy in West London who comes and helps us in all kinds of things. And, you know, I mean, he's the one person, if he disappeared, I don't know what we'd do. The whole Davis household would come to a horrible halt. And we've actually imported a lot of those people, as we all know. And then another one is the social care sector, which is also a training requirement, because it isn't just straightforwardly anybody can go and work in those environments. They can't actually. You know, you do need quite a lot of training to be able to cope with people with dementia or the very, very elderly people. And yet somehow, I don't know quite why it is that I think you and I could have had that discussion 30 years ago.
Yeah,
in more or less the same terms, yeah. But it never seems quite to have been the high priority for the government. And I would say that's another area that we should look at very hard.
I'm sure that's right. It's a good segue, that, to a question we've had in from Tom Clant, who's saying we've got a shortage of skilled manual labour in this country, which I've been talking about. If there's a hard Brexit, is that negative or positive? It means shortage in the short term, but does it mean that our productivity is going to be forced to go up in the longer term, and we're going to be forced to replace those lost jobs by upskilling our workforce? So would the, we haven't talked about Brexit yet, which is another thing coming in down the road into the middle of this crisis, literally into the middle of it. But what's the long-term effect, do you think, of Brexit on our productivity? Because we will begin to have labour shortages in these sort of areas.
Yes, I'm not sure that one can be clear about the impact of Brexit on productivity, because I'm not clear that getting rid of immigrants who've come in, often with quite good skills, actually, developed in Eastern Europe or wherever, and replacing them with people who are being trained up from some other occupation or no occupation, is likely to increase productivity in the economy. I mean, the economy, if there's a net outflow of people, there will be a net reduction in total GDP, but there's no reason why that should change productivity, unless the people who you are retraining domestically are going to be more productive than the ones who they replace. And it's not clear to me why that should be the case. I mean, it might be, but it's not obvious why it should be, actually. If you're training people up for things that they did not choose to do when they could have done, and where they've been sort of brigaded into occupations because other people are leaving them for reasons not to do with the job itself, but to do with where their immigrant status, then I think that's likely at the margin to reduce productivity, actually. If productivity is output per head, I can't quite see why it increases it. Now, it's a national choice that we can make, but I think it's a bit difficult to produce a narrative that tells you why that links Brexit to an increase in productivity. I mean, it could link Brexit to a reduction in British unemployment. That's possible. But whether productivity is a results from that seems a bit of a stretch to me.
Because that has been our problem. Actually, most of our growth in the last 10 years, I think, has been demographically driven. And yes. We've begun to diverge from our competitor economies rather markedly on productivity per head, haven't we?
Yes. We have had two or three different things going on here, I think. One is that our productivity trend changed dramatically after the last recession. And frankly, I don't think that economists have a terrifically good explanation as to why that is. It is to some extent linked with investment, because the two are quite closely related. That if you have a fall off in investment, the likelihood is you have a fall off in productivity. The installed capital per worker, if you like, has not been going up, and that's undoubtedly part of the problem. The other thing about immigration, however, is of course the impact on the shape of the population. And one thing the UK has had going slightly in its favor has been that we're not as dramatically aging a society as some others, particularly if you take a comparison between us and Italy, never mind about Japan, but if you just compare the UK with Italy, you know, we've not got anything like the scale of the aging of the population, which for the sustainability of public finances and sustainability of pensions, et cetera, has been a pretty good thing. And so if we did have a large outflow of working age people who might otherwise have stayed on in this country, that's probably going to be negative from the public finances point of view, because it will put a greater burden on a smaller number of people to support people in retirement. So it's not particularly good from that perspective.
No. Now, as you can imagine, I've had one or two questions in, for example, from Peter. And this is an issue for Coutts clients, well, for all of us, really. If we take it that at some stage down the line, there's going to have to be some fiscal increase in taxation. Do you think that's going to lead us into wealth taxes? Because one of the perceived effects of the crisis has been to shine a light on inequalities again. I mean, do you see that as a political yeah. Response, which would be understandable from the center left and maybe even from the center right? I don't know.
Yes, I mean, the numbers are quite persuasive, actually. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the last few months in terms of savings, that people earning over £50,000 a year, their savings have gone up dramatically. You know, people, as we know from looking at our data in the bank, people who are still in employment and relatively well-off employment, where they're technologically savvy, they can work from home, they've been able to be as productive as they were before, whether they're for a big firm or a small firm or working on their own account, they have had a very significant increase in their savings because they haven't been kind of allowed to spend in the way that they would have done. Whereas anybody earning less than £20,000 has had a significant reduction in their saving, which was probably very small in the first place. And their amounts of money that they have at their disposal have gone down because they've been disproportionately affected by employment. and a lot of them have gone on to benefits with 1.5 million additional people using on universal credit, etc. So whereas the crisis may not have had an impact yet on income inequality, you know, which has actually not been rising that much in the UK. In fact, it's been pretty flat for a while. It certainly looks to have had an impact on wealth inequality. So you can see why people would circle around that and say, some people, well-off people, have done quite well out of this. So maybe they should be the people to make a contribution. I guess the difficulty that a number of other societies have had has been to try to introduce a wealth tax which is politically acceptable and actually collectible. And the French did it, and then Macron withdrew it, which, curiously enough, Hollande became very unpopular for introducing it, and Macron became very unpopular for removing it, which is a bit tough, really, but on French politicians. But interestingly, it was, because it was seen as Macron being, you know, rather grand and supporting his rich friends, etc., because he used to work for Rothschild. You know, all of that used to sort of was kind of paraded as a reason why he did this. But really, one reason why he did it was because it was actually generating remarkably little income for a lot of grief. So my own view is either somebody's going to have to come up with a much more plausible and easier to collect wealth tax than the French managed to deliver, or that the government will possibly work more on, you know, what for a while in the jargon was called mansion taxes, you know, that we increase property taxes. And frankly, there, I'm not sure this will go down a bomb with Coutts customers or indeed with my wife, actually. But, you know, I think that council tax tails off at too low a level, you know, that we should have some higher bands of council tax, which would be, I think, a more acceptable way than some kind of additional mansion tax, etc. And we do know that there are quite a lot of extremely valuable properties in London, you know, and I think it's a 500,000 cap on council tax, and you pay the same at 500,000 or if it's 50 million as a property. And so I think I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find the government looking in that direction and saying, you know, is there some way we can make council tax more progressive, which would be a sort of toe in the water in this area, and we know is achievable. You know, we know it would, it's not technically a complicated thing to do, whereas some of these other wealth taxes, as the French have done, where you're required to assess all your assets, but then of course you have all kinds of offsets and what have you, and it became incredibly complicated and didn't yield a great deal. So I wouldn't be surprised if even the Conservative government decided to look at council taxation.
I suspect you're right on that. And of course, when people talk about wealth taxes politically, you do a poll on it, very popular. But not if they think you're talking about people earning £50,000 a year and more. It means the filthy rich who they've got read about in the newspaper. And of course, there are very, very, very rich people. And if you have a tax on them, they're very mobile on the whole, and you don't raise very much out of them anyway, even if you could define such a group. So that a tax that's of interest to the Treasury has to have a wide base.
Yeah.
Then you have an opinion poll and they say, that's not a bit what I mean by a wealth tax. I don't mean you're taxing me. I mean, you're taxing somebody else.
Yeah.
So it's not quite such a slam dunk politically. And we have capital taxes and we have wealth taxes. Look at the OECD figures. We're sort of in the middle of the pack, really. Yeah. But they're rather, as you say, oddly structured and could probably be reformed and made more efficient.
So, yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I'm completely in favour of a wealth tax for anyone who's, say, 25% more wealthy than me. That seems to me just totally reasonable.
Well, that, in that you share the opinion of the whole country, I mean. Now, going on from there, I've got a question in from Mark. We're going to see a significant number of companies going bust, or I'm afraid there's no question about that. There are going to be companies that can't, that maybe had weaknesses before, which are pushed over the edge, or just their markets disappear. And we went into this recession with a high level of corporate debt, and we're going to come out of it with a very high level of corporate debt and a very high level of public debt as well. So how do, and he asks, how does that affect the banking system in particular? But the indebtedness of corporates and of the government is going to be a very long-term issue for us all, isn't it?
Yes, it is. A couple of observations about that market. One is that, of course, you know, just like I said earlier, that the government's debt burden looks horrific, but the interest burden doesn't look so bad because interest rates are so low. That does apply to corporates as well. So, you know, some large-scale corporate indebtedness, yeah, looks horrible, but actually the effective interest rate is relatively low. So let's not get completely over our skis on this. However, I think it's the case that there will be quite a lot of companies that go find that life is difficult. And even if we have a V, and some of these schemes that were designed to bridge across the V, you know, the land on the other side of the bridge may not be the land you left. And there will be, as you say, there will be some companies whose markets just have gone away. And we can see that in the retail sector, where you know, the growth in online shopping, which was about 10% a year up to the crisis, has now been 50% in the crisis. And is that going to go backwards? I doubt it. And you know, so I think you can see that the retail sector is going to struggle, or some parts of it are. So there will be some changes. Now, the question is what happens. Now, I've been arguing, and the government is not necessarily thrilled about this exactly, because, of course, the government pushed out a large amount of lending, whether these Corona business interruption loans, which are 80% guaranteed by the government, or bounce back loans, which are 100% guaranteed by the government. Banks have pushed them out. And we know that there will be companies who are going to struggle to pay them back. Simplistically, I think that the companies will end up in one of three boxes. One, box one, which is where, yeah, business comes back, maybe even stronger than before. They can pay back this loan, and on we go. Box three will be the ones where it's pretty obvious that they are not going to survive, and in the end, administration or bankruptcy is going to be the answer, at which point the government will have to take their place in the queue like us, and there will, you know, be some kind of resolution and you know, some sort of recovery, but probably not very much in many cases. And then there'll be a third box in the middle of companies which might still be viable, but possibly not with the amount of debt that they have on their balance sheet after this nasty period. And then the question is, you know, how does that restructuring go, particularly when one of the people involved in the restructuring is the government? Now, the reason the government doesn't really like to hear this is because, you know, what, and I completely understand this, the moral hazard problem, saying, by the way, we're lending you all this money, but don't worry, because we don't really expect you to pay it back. You know, we'll turn it into some kind of patient capital instrument at the end of it. So they don't like that message, but realistically, it's going to have to be done. You know, something is going to have to be put in place of these loans for those companies in box two. Now, of course, who then decides? That's an interesting question, because, of course, if I, as RBS or NatWest, if we've also got some other loans out to this company, we are bound, and we are the main banker to the company, we are bound to say, oh, yes, government, you know, please turn this into some equity preference stock or whatever, because that, of course, will protect our other lending. So the government says, not unreasonably, well, hang on, you know, you're not completely unbiased in this. So I think some kind of mechanism is going to be needed in order to try to give an independent view of whether these companies are viable, and then some kind of recapitalization option where the government has some kind of recapitalization agency or whatever, you know, which helps turn these loans into, it doesn't really involve new government money, because the government, the money's already in, if you like. It's a question of what it becomes. And some people have produced some quite clever ideas. So there's an idea floating around, which I think is quite intriguing, which is something called a contingent tax note, which actually would be like a student loan. In other words, you know, student loans, as you know, you get the 9,000 a year, you come out with your debt of 27,000 or whatever it is, and you start to repay if your income is above some level, and it's 23,000 or whatever it is now, you pay 9% of your income above that. And if you don't earn that, then you don't pay at all. So maybe you say, well, this is a government, was a debt. It's now a contingent loan note. If your profits are above X, then we expect you to begin to repay it at some preordained rate. If you don't make profits, well, then it's an instrument which we've put in, and you know, we'll have to live with it. So there are some quite clever ideas, I think, but you're absolutely on the button that if we don't want there to be a massacre of companies as the recovery starts, we're going to have to find some way of converting this debt burden into something which is more manageable.
You answered there a question that came in from Stephen as you were talking earlier, and I think you've provided a very good answer for it. There's also a background argument going on, isn't there, that we should be treating debt and equity more fairly. I mean, that the tax shelter for interest payments and no tax shelter for dividend payments, and which is very nice, I suppose, the private equity market, but. Is that a subject that you think should be addressed, or is that just a theoretical subject? Mm.
No, I do. I mean, Martin Wolf in the FT has banged on about this for a long time and argues that the tax system has a fundamental bias against equity and in favour of debt. There's a rather interesting and rather good paper produced only end of last week, or maybe even this week, Monday, I'm sure I'm not the only one who find the days sort of merge into one when you're in the same place for a while. There's a think tank called Onward, which is one of the conservative think tanks, who produced a rather interesting paper, which actually deals to some extent with the issue I was just talking about, and also says, you know, that a more fundamental reform of the tax system to alter this bias would be justified. Governments have never wanted to go there. I mean, there are, of course, many complications. We could disappear down a rabbit hole on that. But, you know, I do think it's a pity that people don't address it. The difficulty is, I guess, that you could find yourself involved in an international arbitrage opportunity, you know, where if one country adopts a different approach, you know, what would that do? Would everybody go, or would everybody come? Actually, you know, you're never quite sure which what would happen. But I agree with the fundamental point. I think the fundamental point's correct, except that I don't think I've ever seen a well worked out scheme, which would obviously have to be quite a long transition, given the way in which companies have been funded and the basis on which people have put money in different forms. So you'd have to have a long transition period, but I do think it would be a good thing to be able to do in the long run. Yeah.
Well, we're coming up to the last question, I think, which is, it's a political question, really. It comes from Omar, because I want you to say a word about the US-China relationship, because you're pretty, you know a lot about China. Mm. What impact will the result of the US election have on the UK economy, in light of Brexit and all that? But what about the relations between the US and China going forward? Is this going to be what dominates the next generation economically?
Yeah.
Well, first, the election in the US.
The first one, it's a bit difficult because, you know, conventionally, I mean, the US economy has gone reasonably well under Trump, although I think most economists would say that that's been the result of a sugar rush created by tax cuts, and that it's not sustainable or repeatable. But nonetheless, you know, the position that the markets have been fine and the economy continued to recover. But I doubt if he could repeat that trick, frankly, in the second term. So I don't think it's so obvious that Trump would be better from an economic point of view. And from an international point of view, my impression is that, I mean, I don't want to be tempted too far into politics here, but trying to be as neutral as I can on this, that other overseas leaders, I think, betray every evidence of being just a bit tired by this volatility, you know, of Trump. I mean, even where they agree with him, I think the way he expresses and the way he tries to negotiate, etc., it just doesn't fit with the way most other countries want to conduct their international relations. So it's a very unsettling element in the global scene. Now, you know, traditionally the Democrats have not been a soft touch on dealing with China, because of course they represent more organized labor, and organized labor have for a long time been arguing that they've been losing jobs or losing wage increases more perhaps because of super competitive imports from China. And so the Democrats are not natural chums of the Chinese Communist Party, actually. But I think they are more multilateralists, the Democrats, and particularly a slightly old-fashioned Democrat like Biden. So I would expect the Democrats to want to try for a reset of China-US relations to try to reduce the tension. Now, I wouldn't exaggerate the likelihood effect of that, because as I say, there are some underlying strains, and the Chinese approach to intellectual property is very difficult for people to handle. The Hong Kong issue has now arisen as one which, you know, the US will find very difficult to deal with, because in the past they've allowed special treatment for Hong Kong on the basis that it was focusing on the two systems bit rather than on the one country bit. And that, you know, that's going to have to be rethought. But I would think that it would be a more negotiated, you know, someone said to me the other day that the choice between with the US-China relations for the next 20 years is between a Cold War and a Cold Peace. And I think, you know, Cold Peace, I would be personally going for. And I think you might more likely get a Cold Peace with Biden than with Trump.
Thank you, Howard. Well, I'm going to have to wind it up now, and it's been a real privilege to hear from you today, and we've covered a huge amount of ground. Thank you for that very much indeed. And I know we will have, I can see it on the question and answers, a huge surge of interest from our clients in what you've said. So thank you. Before we wind up, I'm going to just mention one other thing, which is that Coutts is seeking to raise £1 million for the National Emergencies Trust through an auction. And through the magic of technology, you're shortly going to see the link to this on your screen. And we are matching, we want to get to the million. I think when I last looked at it, we opened it today, and it'll run for 10 days on the Coutts website. I think we're up to between £40,000 and £50,000 already, and we're matching pound for pound as it goes. I've got a couple of examples of the sort of things the National Emergency Trust does. If you were to bid and win something like having lunch with me, which you might be willing to pay £50 for, well, £50 would
get £10 off from the government.
£10 off from the government, exactly. Thanks to Mr. Sunak.
If it's between
exactly.
Monday and Wednesday.
Exactly. Well, that would pay for 25 hot meals for those affected by domestic violence and living in a women's refuge, proper home cooking made available to them. That's worth it for £50. Now, if you were going to pay £20,000 for the privilege of having lunch with me, rather implausible, I agree, then you could supply all the food banks in Sheffield run by S2 Food Poverty Networks. And that would be really something to have done. So I do encourage all our clients to have a look at the website, get in there. There are many more exciting things. I was being self-deprecating. There are many more exciting things involving Ferraris and Spitfires and all sorts, which you can bid for. Please do so, because we will ensure that the money goes to places where it really does good. So thank you all for listening today. And above all, thank you once again to Howard for an absolutely fascinating interview.
Thank you.
Bye now.